Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the outskirts of Washington, D.C., in the suburb I proudly represent in the Virginia House of Delegates, Alexandria. But I'm close. I could see Washington from my house. Closer even than Sarah Palin is to Russia. Today, I want you to take out your textbooks, turn to page 312, open up your spiral notebooks, get your pen ready. Today is Macroeconomics 101. Wait, don't go anywhere. I know that sounds boring. I'm going to try this hour, frankly, I hope I could do it in a half hour, to attempt the impossible. I'm going to try to explain how economies work, both in our nation and all around the world, what it takes to avert a recession, and why, frankly, I fear that Donald Trump will ruin our economy for the next decade. It's going to get a little wonky, but hopefully not too wonky. And look at it this way. You could take a whole course in macroeconomics. I actually majored in macroeconomics. That was my primary concentration at Harvard College. I graduated magna cum laude. I'm not trying to brag. It may sound like it. But no, I wanted to let you know that I know what I'm talking about so you don't think I'm just kind of, making it up, Trump style. I did study macroeconomics at Harvard. I did graduate magna cum laude. And you know who my thesis advisor was? Guy who just recently died, Martin Feldstein, the former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under Ronald Reagan. So what I'm giving you is not a liberal perspective, as hard as that may be for some of you to believe. I'm giving you an academic perspective. I want you to understand how Trump is ruining the economy. And I'm going to give you some history, talk about what presidents have done right and wrong, including some Democratic presidents that made some mistakes. In fact, the mistake that Donald Trump is about to make was worst made by Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. So I'm not praising every Democrat here. But I think it's important for people to understand the basics of how an economy works so you understand why I believe we're heading to a particularly nasty recession. And in the course of that, I'm going to talk about employment and inflation and deficits and the debt and really strive – I know you're not going to believe this from me, but not to be that political because I think it's important to understand these basic concepts. So again – I'm going to try to keep it interesting. I think I can. I think I can do it. I think I can make macroeconomics interesting. You know, when I studied macroeconomics in the economics department at Harvard, about 11 out of 12 of the graduates, of the undergraduates, I should say, studied microeconomics. Microeconomics. Microeconomics is basically how to make a business work. How do you make a business work? It's easy. There's supply and demand. You buy all the goods. You pay for labor if you're the business owner. And basically, if you make more than you pay out, profit after taxes and expenses, you make a profit. It's not that complicated. Yeah, we can talk about advertising and supply chain and all that kind of stuff. That didn't interest me. It's a heck of a lot easier. But that's probably why 11 out of 12 undergraduates did it. No, I always go for the tough thing. I wanted to know how economies work. What makes inflation go up or down? Why is it that we have these business cycles where we're doing well for a while and then we hit a recession? What causes recessions? This was tougher stuff. And I admit, even though I studied it, even though I got a degree in it, it's still a lot tougher than just how a business works. I assure you, the president has no idea what's going on. But many presidents have, and let me try to basically explain how it works. So a national economy, the American economy, is not like a business. It's not, you take in more than you pay out and you win. That's how a business works. It's not how the nation's economy works because nations can do something that businesses can't. It's called printing money. We can talk in technical terms about the money supply, and I could give you all kind of highfalutin discussion about that. But in essence, it's printing money. If you print money and you're a small business, you've committed forgery, and they might as well put handcuffs on you right now. But if you print money and you're a government, well, that's kind of what governments do. In fact, the failure to print money, the failure to increase the money supply at a time of recession can lead to a Great Depression. In fact, that was Herbert Hoover's classic mistake. Prior to the 1920s, the idea, classical economics is what they taught up to the 1920s. This was before we had great thinkers like John Maynard Keynes. Today, Keynesian economics is understood to be basically how economies work. But up to the 1920s, classical economics was you run your government like you run a business. You take more in taxes than you spend out in spending. And if you do that, you have a surplus. If you don't, you have a deficit. That's still true today. But the thought was that surpluses were good and deficits were bad. And that's true when it comes to your business. Not necessarily true when it comes to an economy. I'm not saying deficits are always good. You can have too much of a deficit. We're going to get to that when we talk about Donald Trump. But I think it's important to understand the history of our nation and the world economy so you understand what causes these business cycles, particularly since I think we're headed for a recession around the next 12 to 18 months. Thankfully, it might be just in time for the election. Not that I want a recession, but if it's going to come, it might as well come at a time when it does the most damage to the current occupant of the White House. Okay, that's my politics. Back to the academics. Prior to the 1920s, you still had business cycles. You had booms and busts. They didn't call them recessions in those days. They called them panics. The panic of 1897, the panic of 1906. And basically, the way it works is this. People, prior to adjusting the money supply, we had something, we actually had something called the gold standard. I mean, you could literally turn in your Federal Reserve note. This is before, the Federal Reserve was created, by the way, under Woodrow Wilson, around 1912 or so, maybe it's 1913 or 14. But prior to that time, nobody controlled the money supply. You actually couldn't really print money. In fact, prior to the Civil War, we didn't have paper money. We had some barter, and we had gold and silver and to some extent copper. And there oftentimes wasn't enough money, and it was really hard to lend money, and it was really hard to collect on your money. And so, you know, you had agricultural booms and busts, and I'm not going to get too back into the 19th century, but the point is the government had really almost no power over the nation's economy. And it just if cotton prices were good and you sold a lot of cotton to the world, you were doing fine. That's frankly how the South did so well prior to the Civil War. They had low labor costs because they didn't pay their slaves. And cotton was a worldwide commodity. They loved their cotton in Great Britain and France. We grew it better in the South. Again, no labor costs. Obviously, human costs, but no cost to the person torturing and mistreating the slaves. So they made huge profits. In fact, it's interesting. If you look at slave families today, a lot of the money in the South to this day comes from exploiting slave labor 200, 300 years ago. And put a plug in on Virginia, the 400th anniversary of Africans arriving to our shore was 2 days ago. August 20th, 2019, 2 days ago, was the 400th anniversary of August 20th, 1619, when the first Africans came to our shore from a Portuguese slave ship and later began slavery and then race-based slavery, which spread throughout the United States. I digress. It's an interesting digression, but I admit I'm digressing. Let's move on. Prior to the Federal Reserve, you just had a set money supply. And basically, people would buy up goods with the set money, and weird things would happen. Like they would discover gold in the New World, and suddenly the money supply would increase because there's a lot more gold around. And if they didn't find new gold for a while, the money supply would contract. And one of the things that we've learned, and they'll teach you if you take a course in macroeconomics, is that the money supply matters. And you might say, why does the money supply matter? I mean, who cares? Money is an arbitrary concept. We choose to say that gold and silver has value. And today we choose that these little paper notes I have in my wallet, we say that's a dollar bill. And this other paper I have here is just paper. So money is arbitrary. Why would the money supply affect real goods? Well, there are reasons for them. Basically, if you want to borrow money, borrowing money is an engine of the economy, right? We know that today as consumers, right? You want to buy a house, you want to buy a car, you may even just want to buy a meal and stick it on your credit card. And remember, half of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. Think about that. All of America's wealth is all controlled by half of Americans. 50% of Americans have no wealth at all. They live paycheck to paycheck. In fact, about 1% of Americans controls 40% of the nation's wealth. Again, I'm digressing, but hey, interesting economic tidbits, right? So people live paycheck to paycheck, and putting something on that credit card, being able to borrow money, or 100, 150 years ago, being able to borrow money if you're a farmer so you can purchase seed and so you can live on that money you borrowed while your seed is in the ground and while it's growing, and then your crops come, and now you make a bunch of money and use that money to pay back your creditor, and that's the cycle. So borrowing and lending is critical to any nation's economy, and if there's not enough money in the system, it can't be done. When we ask ourselves if there's enough money in the system and whether we can borrow money, the term that economists use to describe that, it's one you've heard of before. It's called the interest rate. And the interest rate is what you get when you lend money and what you pay when you borrow money, right? And we all know if the interest rate is 1 or 2%, I could swing that. That'd be great. Can you imagine having a credit card, 1 or 2%, 3%, 5%? I could swing that. I'll buy this now. I'll get my paycheck. I'll pay it all back. I'll be fine. If you're a lender, you may not love it very much. But if you're a borrower, you're going to spend a lot on that 1%, 2%. You know, buy that house. Wouldn't you love to buy a house at 1% or 2%, 3%? Buy a car? Conversely, if the interest rate is 15%, 20%, whoo boy, money is expensive. Kind of like in the olden days when they didn't have enough money around. Now it's really hard to borrow money. I'm not going to buy that car. I'm not going to buy that house. I may not even buy my next meal. I think I'll sit at home. I'll boil some pasta. The interest rate's too high. I'm not going to use economic activity. And when there's no economic activity, think about, well, it's, in economics we call it the multiplier effect, which is a big fancy term. But think about what it means when you buy a car. Is it just, okay, I've given $15,000, $20,000, whatever it is, to somebody else? That's not where it ends. If I buy more cars, then the car employees make more money. And the factory employees make more money, and the factory owner does too, and the dealership makes money too, and then they spend more money because they got more money in their pockets, so they can afford to take that trip to Disneyland that the kids always want, and then they go there, and then the park employees make more money, and the Slurpee machine owner makes more money, and then they spend their money. It's called the multiplier effect. Every dollar spent in the economy doesn't stop there. It goes on six or seven times. So if there's one thing I want to get across in this very first segment, I hope I'm not boring you yet, but consumer spending is the heart of the nation's economy. It's not that business owners say, hey, I'm a good man. I'm going to hire 25 people that I don't need to make widgets that no one will buy. Yeah, no one would do that. The reason why employers hire employees is not out of the goodness of their heart, but because they have products they want to sell. Consumer spending is the engine of the economy, and borrowing money is necessary to make it happen. That's basic economics. Let's examine how it works in the real world right after these messages.
Never confuse Mark Levin with right-winger Mark Levin. The second E stands for empathy, which the other Mark lacks. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Got a conservative who casually misquotes the Bible and the Constitution? Send him to school with Mark Levin.
Levin, welcome back to Macroeconomics 101. I hope I haven't lost too many of you with this wonky stuff. But hey, where else can an hour can you understand how a whole economy works, right? So hopefully you're getting it. So I explained basically why this arbitrary thing called money actually matters, and the supply of money matters, and the interest rate matters to a nation's economy. Basically, lower interest rates mean people will spend more, and higher interest rates means they will spend less. So lower interest rates do fuel, and economy. Now, when you print more money, so how do you lower interest rates? Well, it's complicated, and it's basically the rate that banks charge one another. That's how the Federal Reserve does it. But you can think of it basically like printing money. Do you know where money comes from? The Federal Reserve just says it exists. Some people are very suspicious of that. Ron Paul, his father, was famously very suspicious of the Federal Reserve. Oh, it must be something that the Cognoscenti started in the 1912s and Wilson, and it's very dangerous, and go back to the gold standard. Well, he's an idiot, because if we went back to the gold standard, the government would have no control of the economy. We'd be back to the panics of 1897 and 1904 and whatever it was, and we'd be out of luck. Actually, because we have the Federal Reserve, we are able, to some extent, to control the business cycle. What's the business cycle? The business cycle is the cycle of boom and bust, the cycle of expansion and recession that has existed since the beginning of time, but has generally gotten better when the government can intervene, specifically the Federal Reserve can, than it was back in those boom and bust times when the only way to expand the money supply was to discover a whole bunch of gold. So the basically, a lot of economic understanding comes from the Great Depression. What happened during the Great Depression? Well, what happened is what happens in every business cycle. There's a lot of speculation. People start bidding up prices more because if demand is too hot, we talked about lowering interest rates makes people spend more. Can you ever spend too much? You can. If too many people are spending and everyone's buying and interest rates are crazy low and everyone's borrowing money, remember when everyone's borrowing money off houses that they didn't own, the whole countrywide mortgage crisis, everybody's buying. If everybody's buying, supply is really high, there are not enough products around. What happens? You know what happens. The price goes up. And if everybody's spending more than usual, well, the price goes up and the goods don't change, and that's inflation. And suddenly prices are increased 2, 3, 5, 10, 15. Heck, in the 1970s, 15, 18% inflation. Really, really high inflation. So if you spend too little, well, no one can make the goods. Employers start laying off people because we already talked about the fact that employers don't hire people out of the goodness of their hearts. They hire people because people want their goods. If there's not enough spending in the economy, we have unemployment. We have recession. In worst case, we have depression. If there's too much spending in the economy, then there are not enough goods around. We have inflation, and that's not good either. So the goal of the policymaker is to keep unemployment down and to keep inflation down. Actually, Ronald Reagan coined the term the misery index, add unemployment to inflation. You want that to be as low as possible. So what does that mean for today? We will give you all the details if you'll stay tuned. Coming back after this.
And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, giving you all of economic history in 1 hour. Hey, you know, you didn't pay for it. That's what you get. Okay, so we were in the 1920s. And what happened in the 1920s was all the speculation you can imagine. A lot of times economies go off the track when there's massive income inequality. In fact, it's interesting. We have more income inequality now than any time since 1929. Coincidence? Basically, all the rich people are buying up everything they can. Inflation goes through the roof. And at some point, someone says, I don't think this economy can continue at this pace. We don't have enough labor to make these goods. We don't have enough people buying in foreign markets. What happened actually in the 20s was there was a tariff. That's right. The Smoot-Hawley tariff. Because people said, America first, and we don't want trade with foreign countries, and we're going to close off the world to help our industries. And America did it, and Europe followed suit, and suddenly no one was trading with anyone. And if you know, even Republicans used to understand this. Free trade helps everyone in the world. You know, I may be able to give economics lectures, and you may be able to fix cars. And I really don't need to give myself an economics lecture. I kind of know what I'm talking about. So if I don't sell that, I get nowhere with that knowledge. And you can fix cars, but you only own one car. So if you don't fix my car, you really can't do that much. We trade, right? That's what trade is. I will give you an economics lecture, and you will fix my car. And we both are better off. You know more about economics. I have a working car. Okay, maybe I'm better off than you are. But you get the point. Trade helps. And some nations make sugar better, and some nations have a better supply of iron ore, and other nations have some really good scientists and technicians. And again, world trade helps everyone. But what happened in the 1920s is we decided to be America first, and we tried to do all these tariffs, and the economy started to fall apart. You know, the great economic, great stock market crash of October 1929. Interestingly, the crash of October 1929 was less severe than the economic crisis of 2008, the George Bush recession, the one that helped Barack Obama become president of the United States. That was worse. The economic decline was faster in 2008 due to all the fraud and countrywide and people basically getting mortgages over property they didn't own and slicing and dicing. I'm not going to talk too much about what happened in 2008. It is complicated. But just know that the economic crisis in 2008 was more severe than 1929. But our recession was not as severe because by 2008, smart people working for a smart president named Barack Obama knew what to do to get us out of that ditch. Herbert Hoover in 1929 didn't know. He'd studied classical economics, and classical economics said that, well, just like a business, if times are hard, you better save more. You better not print money. You better raise taxes and cut spending. And if you raise taxes and cut spending, you're going to get a budget surplus, and then you'll be okay for when times are hard. Kind of go back to the old biblical idea, right, of saving when times are hard so that you can have – really, you're supposed to save when times are good so that you have when times are hard. But what did Herbert Hoover did? He tried really hard to balance the budget. He tried, like what Republicans did under Obama, to cut the deficit. And what happened? Well, the government was spending less, right? Interest rates went up because, you know, no one was trying to borrow money. People spent less. Consumers stayed home. They started losing their jobs. So more of them stayed home. We spiraled down into the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover did exactly the wrong thing to do when times are tough. He tried to save budget money. Now, I'm all for budget surpluses in the right time. Bill Clinton, 1990s, great time for a budget surplus. Herbert Hoover, during the Great Depression, terrible time for a budget surplus. Franklin Delano Roosevelt came in, started the New Deal, started massive government spending, the kind that Republicans still complain about today. Franklin Delano Roosevelt saved the nation's economy. Indeed, he saved the world economy. By spending, even by printing money, people went out there, they borrowed money again, they took chances on businesses, people spent more, and we came roaring out. In fact, the only trouble we had with the New Deal was around 1936 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt thought, maybe I should pull it back a bit, go back to classical economics, and we had another little dip. All the way up to World War II, again, I'm not, you know, I think that was a justified war, but whatever you think about military conflict, it's very, very expensive. It costs a lot of money. So totally apart from the human cost of war, which is extreme, you should know that when you spend a lot of money, whether it be on guns or butter, as a nation, you're going to cause the economic engine to go. Now, I'd rather build bridges than make tanks, but economically, in fact, I would argue bridges are better for the economy than tanks because tanks, it's only the cost of making the tank, whereas bridges, when you build them, it doesn't just the cost of building the bridge. It's also people save money as they cross the bridge. It makes transportation costs less. So actually, bridges are better than tanks. But roughly, government spending makes an economy move along. Franklin Delano Roosevelt got us roaring out. Then the 1950s, well, we were the only nation kind of still standing after World War II. Europe was decimated. So we had a great economic engine. We could easily compete with the rest of the world, which was falling apart. We had great spending. 1950s was roaring. 1960s, you found really low inflation. Times were really good. in the 1960s. Not so good for African Americans, and people left out of the economy. That's true, but not my point. My point about the economics is that people, well, white people, middle class white people, were able to spend money, and blacks started to be included in the 1960s as well. Basically, if you, by the time you're in 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, the time of Lyndon Johnson, our economy is pretty good. We've got really low inflation and low unemployment. The best of both worlds. Kind of like where we were in 2016 when Barack Obama left office. But Lyndon Johnson made a mistake. No, Johnson's a Democrat. This isn't Democratic Republican. This is just economic facts here. Lyndon Johnson made a mistake. What was his economic mistake? Lyndon Johnson wanted to fight the Vietnam War. And Lyndon Johnson didn't want to pay for it. Now, he didn't want to pay for it for political reasons. He knew that if he raised taxes to go to war in Vietnam, then all the people who are angry at us fighting over there in Southeast Asia, and let's face it, the tens of thousands of Americans that were dying, right? 50,000 died in the Vietnam War. All those kids protesting would join with all the conservative business owners who didn't want their taxes raised to pay for a war that no one could really understand really what it was doing. So Lyndon Johnson said, well, I still want to fight the war, but I don't want to pay for it. So what did he do? Without raising taxes, he massively increased spending. Spending on the Vietnam War, spending on horrible things like Agent Orange, spending on tanks, spending on military, spending without raising taxes, leading to a big deficit. See, I'm not one of those people like some silly Republicans. Deficits are always bad, or they're a caricature of liberals. Deficits are always good. No, the answer is sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. In Herbert Hoover's day, not having a deficit was stupid. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was right to have a deficit and a debt. And in World War II, we had debt even greater than the entirety of goods the nation could produce, what's called the gross national product. The highest we've ever had is World War II. That was the time to spend to pull us out of the Great Depression. But when times are good, like they were in the 1960s, that's the worst time to spend. Bill Clinton understood that. Times were good in the 90s when it get to him, and he saved money. He gave us budget surpluses. But Lyndon Johnson, more because he didn't want to pay for his war than anything with economics, decided to spend when we were already at maximum full employment. Unemployment was low, and yet we have all this government money coming in. What happens? Well, I told you what happens. When there's no more goods to be produced and a whole bunch more money comes in, that leads to inflation. Lyndon Johnson's mistake in the 1960s led to a decade of economic crisis, arguably 15 years. I mean, all the way from the early 70s up until the early 80s. A lost decade. Do you remember the 1970s? Were you around in the 1970s? What do we have in the 1970s? We had high inflation and high unemployment. People were miserable. Now, it started under Richard Nixon. Note that I blamed Lyndon Johnson. Nixon kept up a lot of these policies. He didn't want to pay for the Vietnam War either. And it has a bit of a lagged effect, these things. It takes time for prices to build up. It takes time to have inflation. But basically, by the time we had all this massive inflation, then came what's called the oil shocks of the 1970s. I don't want to get into too much detail, but basically OPEC raised oil prices because they didn't like our support of Israel and all kinds of other things. Anyway, the oil was necessary to the American economy much more than it is now. Today we have alternative measures much more. Anyway, the heart of it is Lyndon Johnson set it up. We have all this massive inflation. Then come these economic shocks from outside, and now we have unemployment. So into the 1970s, 1974, was the worst recession since the Great Depression. It was terrible. And unemployment was going up, and inflation was going up, and people were miserable. And poor Jimmy Carter largely got the same policies that were left over from Ford and Nixon and even Lyndon Johnson. So Carter, in 1978, actually took the steps needed to give us back the good economy roaring in the 80s and 90s. Everything in economics has a lagging effect. And what he did is he hired a guy by the name of Paul Volcker, V-O-L-C-K-E-R, and he would lead the Federal Reserve. Paul Volcker, if you ever seen a picture of him, he's like 6'7" or 6'8", whatever. He's and he's got this sort of angry look on his face all the time, bald guy. But he believed in austerity measures. And what Paul Volcker did is he raised interest rates through the roof. Raised interest rates through the roof led us to a massive recession that Ronald Reagan largely continued when he kept up Paul Volcker. And so from 78, 81, 82 was another recession. And you're like, why would a policymaker purposely cause a recession? Well, unfortunately, I think he needed to. He needed to break the back of this Johnsonian inflation left over from the Vietnam War, left over from a decade earlier. If you raise interest rates really, really, really high, you can finally break the back of inflation. You can basically cause so much damage to the economy that people stop hiring. You kind of intentionally cause recession, and finally, those prices go down again. And that's what happened in the early 80s. And so after we went through those austerity measures, poor Jimmy Carter lost his election because of it, even though he'd set up the process to do the right thing. And then by 82, 83, we turned it around. By 84, the economy was good again. The economy was good again. We had relatively low inflation, relatively low unemployment, and Ronald Reagan rode that in. And what did Ronald Reagan do? He cut taxes for rich people in 86, just at the time we didn't need it. Just at the time when we'd already gotten out of the early 80s recession, we didn't need it. We had another recession under George Bush Sr. But basically, Clinton comes in the 90s with the technology economy, and it's actually pretty good. The early 90s, going all up through the late 90s, we have an economic boom due to technology, this new thing called the internet, the new computer revolution. We're doing pretty well. And unemployment gets so low that Bill Clinton does something amazing that we hadn't seen since, well, Jack Kennedy in the 1960s. Bill Clinton runs a budget surplus. Republicans are consistent. Any economist will tell you the time to run a deficit is when you have high unemployment, and the time to run a budget surplus is when unemployment is low to keep inflation down. That's Keynesian economics. That's what we've been talking about that we've known ever since the 1920s. Republicans have a very different view of when to spend. Their view is, when a Democrat is in power, all deficits are bad, all debt is bad, we want no government spending, we don't want government spending on things like health care, paid family medical leave, Social Security, Medicare, education, roads, bridges, alternative energy, all that liberal stuff. So anytime a Democrat's in power, deficits are bad. But anytime Republicans in power, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Donald Trump, Democrats, if they haven't, spend it on middle class people, on poor people, all the people we don't give a damn about. But we want to give money to billionaires. We want to make billionaires have even more money, and we can do that. So Republicans have always run much, much higher deficits in debt than Democrats. Don't take my word for it. You look at it. Trump higher than Obama. Bush higher than Obama. Bush way higher than Clinton. Clinton way lower than Bush and Reagan before them. Republicans, the ones who claim they believe that they're against the debt, they're lying. They just say it when Democrats are president. But the point is, in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, we had so little deficit that we actually had a budget surplus. Now, we still had this debt that we were paying down, but that was a great time for a surplus. It was the 1990s. Unemployment was low. Inflation was low. Thank you, Bill Clinton. We were actually paying down on the debt. Life was good until George W. Bush became president, and he had another war, a war he did not want to put on the national tab. So George Bush cut taxes, spent on war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and didn't pay for it, and started messing us up again. And that would go all the way until the great economic collapse of 2008. When we come back after the break, I'll take us from 2008 till today and say why I'm so concerned that Donald Trump may lead us to the worst economy since the 1970s. Right back after this.
Schooling the GOP, one hand tied behind his back, the Constitution in the other. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Got just a few minutes left to finish all of economic history We're now in the late O's. The economy is collapsing. Basically, you've got this fraud committed by the slicers and dicers on Wall Street who are playing with mortgages. They're not being regulated. Unregulated capitalism often leads to these booms and busts. Our economy is in free fall. George Bush has no idea what to do. And Barack Obama says, stimulate the economy. Bush does nothing until Obama takes power. He takes power January 20th, 2009, and does a whole bunch of really good things. We don't have enough time to go into the detail, but basically he primes the pump. He puts a lot more government spending in to help save the economy. We've learned that's what you do when the economy is in free fall. And the stock market turns around, economics are booming, and within 7 months of taking office, we're not losing jobs anymore, we're making jobs. And President Obama gave us the largest, strongest economic boom we've ever had. In fact, it still lasts today. So, Obama leaves office, unemployment is low, inflation is low. He basically gives Donald Trump on a silver platter a perfect economy. And what does Donald Trump do? He does what Lyndon Johnson did 50 years earlier. He says, I'm going to give rich people a massive tax cut. Well, Johnson didn't give rich people a massive tax cut. Johnson spent money on the war in Vietnam. But what Donald Trump does is says, I'm going to increase the debt. I'm going to increase the deficit like no one's ever increased it before. Every Republican president lifts up the debt. They're all liars when they say they care about the debt. I'm going to make it so we have a $1 trillion deficit every single year, as far as the eye can see. I'm going to raise our debt higher than even the gross national product, the sum total of all goods that Americans create in a single year. Why? Because he's got to pay off his donors. He owes it, right? I mean, he's not out to help middle-class people. He's out to help billionaires. And so he gives us massive differentials where a few people own most of the nation's wealth. He helps pad the pocket of most of his friends, and he pads his own pockets. I mean, this is a guy who became president in order to pad his own pockets. The point is, what he does doesn't build infrastructure that lasts for generations. He still hasn't done that. He doesn't make it easier for people who have sickness, doesn't provide for health care the way Obama did. He's not giving the kinds of things that lead middle-class people to spend a lot of money. So the middle class people are not spending anymore, and he's harming, again, working class people. He's doing tariffs. Remember the Smoot-Hawley tariff I told you about in the 1920s? Donald Trump's doing the same thing with China. He's harming farmers, and then he's trying to pay for farmers with more tax money. What he's basically doing is spending, spending, spending when times are good, and consumers aren't spending anymore because, let's face it, they're not doing better. Only very rich people are doing well. And one of the things you learn about the multiplier effect is that rich people save most of their money. They don't spend it. Another $1 million for Donald Trump, what does that matter? Whereas $10,000 to someone who needs that second car, they're going to spend it. So by giving all this money to rich people, he massively increases the debt, massively increases deficits, doesn't cause ordinary spending to grow. What does that mean? It means we're going to have massive inflation. It's coming. And it also means we're going to have massive unemployment, because poor people are going to get worse off and consumer spending drives the economy. So, massive inflation, massive unemployment. It could take a decade to cure it, just like it did in the 1970s. Donald Trump is making the Lyndon Johnson mistake. And recession, unfortunately, is just around the corner. I hope you enjoyed your macroeconomics lesson today. Feel free to share this with whomever needs a good lesson in how the nation's economy.